Hi everyone, I'm Manny, and you're listening to Bayan Bayou with Manny. This 7-episode podcast on anti-Asian hate, being Cambodian, and COVID-19 gives voice to Khmer 1.5 and second generations who are championing change in a time of racial divide in America. These stories showcase their unique journey of struggles and successes to make a difference in a country in which they call home. Today, I'm talking to Vantatmon, also known as Mitch. He is a registered nurse at Innova Fairfax Hospital, a father of two sons, and a survivor of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge genocide. From a childhood as refugee to growing up to become a helping professional, Mitch has dedicated himself to ensuring the health and welfare of others. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit America in early 2020, Mitch was there on the front line. Hi, Mitch. Welcome.
Hello, Manny. Thank you. Thank you for bringing me into the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Before we talk about your experience as a first responder during the pandemic, I want us to take a quick look back. Even though I'm familiar with the Cambodian American refugee experience, your family story stood out to me. Your time as an illegal refugee in Thailand was short, but it was harsh. How bad was it?
It was pretty bad. I've heard stories of many people who have gone through it. In their opinion, their story is pretty bad. And then I start listening to everybody's stories, and I thought my story is the same thing as theirs. But in reality, my story is actually pretty difficult compared to other people's experiences. My family and I, we decided to leave Cambodia around 1985, roughly around there. Took us about 5 years or so to finally get to the United States. Through that time, trying to leave the country, we had been jailed in Chiang Mai for about maybe 6 months or so. After we were released, we decided to try to come back again. We stayed in multiple little camps prior to coming to the main camp.
Right. When you and your family escaped Cambodia to a refugee camp in Thailand, your family was tricked by the guide who brought you to the camp. You guys were arrested and jailed. Can you walk me through what happened and what was it like?
So we escaped the first time out from Cambodia to supposed to be like a little temporary camp, and then supposed to go into Khao Dang. But my dad was the first one who went first to see if the route was okay. So he went and he said it was okay. The person who's taking you is legit. So it was my grandmother, my uncles, everybody, the whole family. They stuff was in this army truck, pretending these army trucks are supposed to be, I guess, carry, military equipment. But they put us in there in the back and with a curtain in behind. So if they open at the back, they couldn't see us. They just see the equipment. But of course, the person who was leading us, he actually worked for the government and took us back to a camp and say, hey, these illegal people is trying to leave the country. Since then, we were jailed. They brought it to a government area and treason, I think. So that was the term that they used because we were trying to leave our country. During jail time, every 3 months or so, they ask you again. They said, you're going to leave. Why are you going there? This is your country. So they ask you these questions. If they believe that you're not going to leave anymore, they'll let you come out. I think by around the 3 month mark or the 6 month mark, we pass the test and it's okay. You are safe to go because we feel like you're not going to leave the country anymore.
When you and your family were jailed, how were you treated?
for the kids and the woman, they put us in a different area, which had a little bit more freedom, which had a little more food, which they didn't really beat you, or they didn't really do anything to you at all. They kind of just left you alone. But, you know, food was scarce, and clothing was scarce, bathing was scarce. But the men, otherwise, men, they treat them really, really bad. They put them in like a little cell, 10 by 10, with like 100 people in there, but all kind of criminals, like murderers, robberies, all rapists and all the stuff like that. So the men had it a lot worse than the kids and the woman. We didn't get it bad. I mean, my brother actually remembered as a good time, because he just remembered playing all day. He didn't have to go to school. He has plenty to eat. He didn't have to do anything. So to him, it's actually a good time for him in jail. For me, I didn't have a bad. I didn't have a bad time either.
Right, you were too young. Maybe I mentioned this in our earlier conversation, but my family and I, we stayed in the refugee camp called Khao Dang Camp in Thailand for about 4 to 5 years. But this brings me back to your story and your family. You guys were an illegal refugee, meaning you did not have any documents or any entitlement to live in the camp. What was that like, being an illegal refugee in a refugee camp?
During that legal time, it's pretty rough. When you come to the Khao Dang camp, pretty much every week or every month, unannounced, a Thai soldier would come and try to either evict an illegal one to go back, or send them back to the country, or do whatever they need to do. And a lot of time, if you have money, if you have cash, if you have whatever, they'll let you go and let you stay for another week until they come by and ransack the community again to find the illegals.
As an illegal refugee, you had experienced unannounced raids. You would move from different foxholes to hide from the soldiers. Describe to me what it was like to live and hide in a foxhole and to constantly hide from authorities.
One experience that stood out the most was, I just remember I was at that time probably around 9 years old, the raid happened, and everyone in the family kind of dispersed, because you don't want to be caught in one family and everyone's going to be sent to Sokmar. So my dad went left, my mom went right. We found a foxhole that we could go to with another family that was in there. So three of us, my baby brother, me, and my mom, went to this foxhole. I just remember the experience of the foxhole. I mean, literally, it's cold, it's damp, it's small. There was another family there. It's dark. I don't know who they were, but I just remember there's a few people. I couldn't even count how many they are because it is so dark. And the foxhole is underneath someone's home that was legal, that was there, and they dug it to protect this illegal, because all the Khmer people in that camp kind of helped each other out. And I just remember the soldier was, the owner of the house said, "We can stay, be quiet, because the soldier's coming. And then my little brother, I don't know at that time, was he scared? Was he sick? Don't quite know, but he was crying. He was making all these noises. Everyone in this foxhole, we got caught.
And how dangerous are these raids?
When you are being caught by this Thai soldier, it's unpredictable what they're going to do to you. Sometimes they stab you. Sometimes they hit you. Sometimes they rape the woman. Sometimes they beat up the men. Sometimes if you have cash, you give it to them, they let you go. You don't know any of these things, what will happen. They're very unpredictable depending on who they are.
Right. At one point, while hiding in the foxhole, your mom left you so that she could protect other people from getting caught, because your brother was crying. And you were, what, about 8 or so? What was going through your mind then? And how scared were you?
My mom said, I have to leave with your little brother. You have to stay here. So me hearing that, I'm losing everybody. I don't have my dad. I don't have my aunts. I don't have my grandmother. And I'm the only one there. And my mom and my brother is leaving. I started to shake. I started to cry, you know. And she told me, she said, "You, Todd, you cannot cry. You can't cry. If you do, these people might be caught, might be killed." At the age of 9, when your mom say that, mm-hmm. You are scared to death. What runs through my mind is I may not ever see my brother and my mom again. Right, the whole entire time I was just crying, but didn't make any noise. And when my mom left, but in my mind, I never thought she was going to be back.
So obviously, you've survived the hideout. But what was it like to finally reunite with your mom and your family?
So minutes turned to hours turn to longer hours, you know, by around maybe 3 hours pass by, I finally saw my mom and my baby brother came by, and oh my God, it's like the biggest joy that I have. And everything was forgotten once I saw her.
Wow. That's a lot for an 8-year-old to have to go through. How long did you guys stay in the refugee camp for?
So Kaoyang, I was there roughly, probably, I think, maybe a year.
Coming up, Mitch says starting a new life in a new country was difficult due to being bullied at school.
Why are you eating that? Why are you playing that way? Why do you smile that way? Why do you walk that way? You know, all these things start to come through as you understand more and more and more. All of it wasn't positive at all.
After this incredibly harsh ordeal in Thailand, you got accepted to come to America. Your family was part of the third wave refugees entering the United States. What was your first day like in coming to America?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So the first thing that intrigued me the most was landing in the United States, right? So growing up, we never really have running water, electricity, or anything like that. The first thing you see is bright. Everything is lighted up, you know, like a Christmas tree. You know, it's like, oh my God, everything is so perfect. You know, it's, you feel like you in a land of opportunity. This is it. You made it. Right. This is all what you want. And you are here. You were so excited. You know, you're so excited. You can't, you don't want to eat. You don't want to drink. You just want, you know, just you just want to look and absorb,
right.
You know. Yeah. Just take it all. And my dad always says, like, you put a monkey in the city. You know, you've never seen these things. And all you do, you stick your head out the window as my uncle driving me from the airport to home. I mean, all four of us is in the car. I mean, four of our head is outside just looking, just taking it all in because we've never seen anything like this in our life, you know, the car lights, the buildings, the street, the road, you know, what else? I just remember seeing so much light out there. Light amazes me because we don't see this much light anywhere.
Wow. Cosmopolitan overload, I'm sure. And what were some of the initial struggles in living in a new country as a refugee?
So all this excitement, all these awe, all these almost like this honeymoon phase of the United States come crashing down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I could see the honeymoon being over real quick. And how did it come crashing down for you?
Even though I studied English, but I didn't really take it seriously. So I know some, but don't know to speak a lick of English. I may understand some, but I don't. So school start, and this is where everything kind of turned sour for me. You know, the land of opportunity came to the land of trash at that moment, you know. And then as weeks and months passes by, you start to understand a little bit the body language, the way people talk, the way people act. You know, it's not your culture, so everybody do things a little bit differently. So then you start to pick up on subtle things that people do that these are all not positive things that they're doing to you, you know. So the giggle, the laugh, the stares, like, you know, you're like, you're different. You don't speak our language. You don't act the same way as we do. Your haircut is weird. Your shoes is weird. Why are you eating that? Why are you playing that way? Why do you smile that way? Why do you walk that way? You know, all these things start to come through as you understand more and more and more. And all of it wasn't positive at all. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So things started to build up. I came in when I was like in the middle of fifth grade. And then when by the end of sixth grade, that was when things spiraled down to a point that the verbal abuse, the taunting, even the physical abuse, the pushing of the shovel started to get to me. You know, at certain times during my sixth grade, you know, suicidal thought is just coming through my head, you know. Usually it was like monthly, and then it was like weekly, and then it's like daily. Like, I did not want to go to school. I didn't want to wake up. I just stayed in bed and just never looked forward to going to school because it's just awful, you know, like the most awful thing a kid could ever think. And I came in right when you were a teenager, you know, like 12 and 13, when hormone is crazy, the kids are not very nice, no one understands you. you know, and you don't have any friends, you know, everyone is gone. You just have your family, but your family's not even there with you because they are trying to do their thing to survive also.
Right. You were brought up in the shadow of genocide and you guys were just trying to survive all around. As you mentioned earlier, you struggle with self-confidence and emotional abuses and bullying from your peers at school. Did you share these with your parents?
My parents already have enough burden to try to raise, three kids, to put another burden for them to try to fix because I'm having difficulty. Because, you know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted new clothes. I wanted, shoes that could fit in. But I was so afraid to ask them because they are struggling themselves. You know, they're living in a house that they barely could afford. We were living in a tiny home with like three other families because we couldn't really afford anything else. They both were making minimum wage. They come in making what I think at that time minimum wage was like $3, $4, something like that. They were making $4 an hour. So I didn't really tell them because I didn't feel the need to. And I feel like it's, you know, so I just deal with all that problem myself.
I could only imagine coming here as a young teen and having to go through all of these struggles. How lonely was it for you?
No, I was very lonely at that time. You know, like a house full of family, I always feel alone because I was the oldest one. So I have to be the babysitter. I have to feed them and I have to watch them until the parents come home. At the age of 9, I was watching 5 kids.
Yeah, you were the caretaker.
Yeah, I was pretty much a caretaker because my parents were I think some of them worked at nighttime, so they were sleeping, whatever, or majority of them is not home. And my uncles and stuff, sometimes they come in and out because they were taxi drivers. But I was like the sole adult when after school, when they come home. And of course, my social skill, and that even take a toll because I didn't have any friends for that 2 years because I couldn't really go out and hang out with what normally normal American kids would do. They go out and play basketball, whatever, hide and seek with their friends. I didn't have any. My friends was my siblings.
As you said, you did not have a life outside of the family unit because you couldn't afford to be a kid. You had to grow up real fast and real quick. How bad was the mental health at that time for you?
At my lowest point was I was thinking about suicidal thought was pretty much every day, right? So I don't know. I have no idea what snapped, but at the end of it, I just remember the end of it going to middle school. So the thought of going to middle school was a new beginning for me. So I said to myself, look, you're going to a different school. No one knows you. Going to be new teachers. It's going to be a new beginning. So I told myself with this new beginning, this will not happen again. I had a goal in mind. I said, look, whatever this is happening now, it's going to be erased. Just like whatever is happening in the refugee camp, once we hit the United States street, it's going to be a new beginning. So my thought was the same thing. This is a new beginning for me to middle school. And whatever that happened in elementary school, it's going to go away. I'm going to put an end to it.
This new beginning that you made to yourself and the determination that came with it, what changed or clicked for you to make that shift?
So it was a new beginning. Once I hit middle school, I had a job, like a little part-time job. I got enough money to get clothing that could fit in. And then I had the time to hang out, to make friends. So my social skill had picked up and I was a little bit more accepted. I look more like them now when I went into middle school. I talk, even though I didn't speak much, but I also was in a class called ESL. I think you probably know English as a second language, but I have a little subgroup that I hang out with. Then it opens up, say, hey, I'm not the only one that's feeling this way. These guys feel the same way. We're going through a struggle, but with the struggle, you have this the subgroup that support each other. Say, hey, I don't care if they speak a language. I understand you. You understand me. We do the stuff that they could do the same thing, but we just don't speak enough language. But we got along well. I had friends who are there, and I was still friends with them now, starting in ESL class. And they all became very successful in life. because, you know, we stuck together through the tough time.
That's a great example of resetting and finding your own community and your own support network.
Yeah, I pretty much, my ESL class was my support group pretty much, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because in a regular school, the same thing, you always get mocked at. But when you have someone else around you, so you're okay. Even if they mock at you as a group, you feel protected and you don't feel as vulnerable. When you're by yourself, that's when you feel very vulnerable, right?
Yeah, you found a group of friends that are familiar and are relatable to you and accepted you for who you are. So I'm glad you were able to have that experience. I was also put in ESL when I first came to Toronto, Canada. I was put in fourth grade and I was the only Asian in that class. So I didn't really have a group or a support group, as you called it. We talked about you being bullied earlier and at some point you contemplated suicide. Let us now talk about racism. Did you experience anti-Asian hate growing up in America?
I've heard a lot of people talk about racism. I've heard talk in the United States there's a racism going on, and I don't think racism in the United States is as bad as any other country that I encounter, like especially our country, Cambodia, Khmer, it's very racist. The Chinese, the Japanese, every country has racism. And I think the United States do have racism, but I don't think it's as pronounced as other countries. So with that said, I personally never really encountered any racism that either changed my life or that have a pronounced effect on me.
Right. Racism is worldwide and it's not just in America. What about your experience in being a new refugee in this country and being bullied? Was that race related or something else?
When the suicidal thoughts in elementary school, I don't think that was racism. I think they're just kids being kids because I was different. I don't think they'd look at me and say, hey, you're Asian and we should treat you this way. No, because when I went to the elementary school, white people were a minority because we live in a neighborhood that's predominantly immigrants. Even growing up in high school, when I went to elementary school, my neighborhood around where I lived is 80% immigrants.
And where did you live in Virginia?
So I live in Falls Church, a place called Coolmore. Okay. So if you go to that area, I mean, 80%, 90% of you go to the school is immigrants. And my high school was named, was in the National Geographic for have the most nationalities in it. So I never encountered racism at all, you know, throughout growing up through life, even my career. And I chose a career in nursing and I work in a hospital that in Fairfax Hospital, which predominantly is immigrants, you know. So I never encountered such thing what people are saying. I'm not denying there's no racism at all in this country. But I personally never had any encounter that is so detrimental that it changed the way I think. There's certain patients that say, hey, you know, you look Chinese. I mean, that's as far as I get, you know, from racism around this area.
Right. And it's worth noting that you live in a predominantly Asian community. We all have different experiences with racism. And for you, that was just not your experience.
Not my experience at all. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Some people may have a different experience than me.
Coming up, Mitch says there was a lot of stress in being a nurse at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic.
But during a pandemic, you bring work home because work follows you. If they know you're a nurse, certain people don't want to be around you. People don't want to talk to you because you might have the disease, because no one knows what that disease is.
However, you have experienced a mental health crisis as a teen. Was that one of the reasons why you are a nurse? Because of your strong empathy for others and your understanding of other people's suffering?
My life is always in turmoil, and I always think that, you know, there should be less turmoil in people's lives. If people help each other, I think there would be less. You know, so I always feel like I need to do something to help. you know, even being a nurse, even being a gardener. If you're helping someone in any type of aspect, it's a positive. That's why I went into nursing, because in my heart, I knew I want to do something in to help people, to be a part of the world that I could help them get better. I start to volunteer at like nursing home, at like hospital and stuff like that. It gave me so much pleasure to bring a tray of food to someone who couldn't come out to socialize with a group. And I was the one person that was talking to a man that when he was in his heyday, he was a captain and everyone was well respected. And now when he is old and demented, their respect was gone. Everyone kind of abandoned the man, you know? To me, I feel like schooling is a bridge to do what you want to do, but what you want to do is help. If you want to help, you could start helping as soon as possible. So then I went to school not knowing what nursing was, not knowing what the medical field was. It's kind of, it kind of led me that way with my grades, with the way I study and stuff like that. So I went to it, started getting my first job, at the hospital. And for me, yeah, sometimes my job is not very enjoyable. But then if I don't go to my work at like maybe if I have three or four days, I feel like, God, I feel like a waste, you know, like I'm just so by the third day, I'm antsy.
Sounds like you really love what you do for a living.
I do. I do. I do love what I do. I can't think of anything less that I want to do. The reward I got from the feeling of helping people overshadow the bad stuff that happens in nursing.
In doing this podcast, I have spoken with a Cambodian psychiatric social worker who's also a mental health first responder. She said she is seeing an increase in children and young teens wanting to commit suicide. And according to the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, between April and October of 2020, hospital emergency departments saw an increase in the share of total visits that were from kids for mental health needs. What are your thoughts about this? Have you seen this in your hospital?
So I work on the adult side, but even on the adult side, I see an uprise in suicidal and in drug abuse and alcoholic abuse and stuff like that. My thought with that is, human being is a social creature, right? So if we start to isolate people in their own home, not letting them out over and over and over, you could only take it at a certain each people have their length or period how lonely they want to be, right? But if we keep isolating people, I guarantee the more psychiatric micro issue is going to happen more and more, because like I said, we all are social creatures. We need to see each other. We need to talk to each other. We need to have contact with each other. This is what people do. That's what we are. Talking on the phone and texting is not the same as in person touching and talking and laughing in face. When the pandemic happens and isolation was at its peak at that point. So does psychiatric health, because we can't talk to each other. My kids, you know, my kids don't talk to any friends. They sit around and talk on their microphone. They are not out there playing. They're not out there, you know, tackling each other. These simple thing of touch, of human contact, make a huge difference in mental health. We had a lot of alcoholic, increase of alcoholic withdrawals because people start drinking more. People start using they start using recreational drugs more, and you ask because they have nothing to do.
Yeah, that was their way of coping and escaping, because COVID was hard. It was hard for everyone. COVID. Let's talk about COVID. The death toll in the U.S. topped 500,000 in February of 2021. You have been a nurse for 15 years. Have you seen anything like this before? And how crazy has it been for you?
No, I mean, I never seen anything like this before in my life. I mean, yes, I've been a nurse for a very long time. And this COVID, oh my gosh, you make, you know, the people you always hear, oh, nursing is really hard. Nursing is really hard. Yeah, you can't describe how hard it is when COVID hit. You know, there's no words. I mean, it just, so hard. I mean, hard, not just, you know, just physical, it's mental, it's so environmental, everything is hard, you know, and And then you come home and then no one wants to be with you. Everyone's afraid of you, you know, and it's just a whole, it's just not one aspect. It's your whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, before, you know, nursing, before the pandemic happened, you know, it's work. When you come home, you're free. You know, at work, you don't bring work home. But during a pandemic, you bring work home because whole work follows you. If they know you're a nurse, certain people don't want to be around you. People don't want to talk to you because you might have the disease because no one knows what that disease is.
It was crazy. And there was a lot of things we didn't know at the time. And everybody was freaking out.
It was scary. My neighbor, very good friend of mine, has a home gym. And we were really, really good friends. We used to work out with each other and stuff like that. And then one day, he was talking. He said, yeah, you come and work out. I said, okay. Are you sure? You know, he said, yeah. Well, so I came there, work out one time. Well, the second time, things happened. Like, I started noticing he is very scared of me. Like he didn't let his kids go downstairs anymore after a workout. He didn't want to put his, no one allowed to go downstairs anymore like that. Then I knew right away that I'm causing more burden for him, for me to go in there because he is freaking scared of death to me, you know, like right. Me being in his house. So that stood out for me in the pandemic is because he was a really close friend, but don't understand enough. That he was fearing for his life, but also trying to help me out, you know. But I don't want people to feel, you know, to feel that about me, so I stopped going. But that was the whole story of being a nurse at a pandemic area is not because it's hard at work. You come home, it's hard at home also.
Right. It's hard both sides.
Yeah, it's hard both sides, you know.
Let's talk about you and your profession as a nurse during the beginning of the pandemic, when the death toll was really high. Take me to your hospital and describe to me what happened at that moment in time.
All right. So let me take you there. So so it hits Mount Vernon, Alexandria, D.C. That was the first spot that it hit first. So I was deployed to Mount Vernon. At that time, hundreds of patients who comes in, people who are not sick enough, we sent them all home because we can't do anything. We need to save the beds for the sick one to be ventilated. Ventilated is pretty much the killer of COVID, the killer of a COVID patient, pretty much. So the initial treatment was all about ventilating a patient, which means putting a tube down their throat and let the machine take care of it so you could contain the virus. The successful rate of doing that way was about 20 to 10%. That's very low successful rate. So that's why China, that's why Italy, the population dies off quickly because everybody was ventilated. Once we know the ventilation is wrong, now there's many ventilators available everywhere. Now we don't ventilate a patient anymore. The only time that the hospital or the doctor is going to ventilate you is when you get very confused, which means your oxygen level in your bloodstream is very low. But every time you ventilate a patient, they don't come out of it, you know. So the best way to make a patient survive is let them stay as long as possible without ventilating. Ventilator is your last resort, not your first resort. Before, it was almost like a first resort. If you feel like you're having difficulty breathing, we are ventilating you.
Wow. Everything is always 20/20 in hindsight. You know, the stuff that we know now, we did not know before. So again, scary stuff. Coming up, Mitch says compassion for others starts with self-care.
And to practice this, I would say it starts off with yourself. You have to be healthy yourself. To be compassionate to others, and it comes out and people could read you fairly quickly.
How many hours were you working in a day and how did you cope with it all?
So I would leave my house around 5 o'clock. Sometimes I don't get home until like 10. For legality purposes, we can't stay longer than 16 hours. So I could get caught up between around at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. There's no way you could do that long because it become unsafe at that time. With my exercise regime, with my sleep regimen, and also eating a well-balanced diet, I think that helped me cope a lot. But overall, I think my experience from the past helped me cope more than anything else.
Sounds like your experience as a refugee helped you build a strong mental toughness.
Right. I kind of built that mental toughness. This is just like another bump in my life, you know, and I know how to deal with. I think this was bad, but I don't think this was bad compared to when I had the suicidal thoughts in middle school, or when my mom told me, hey, you need to shut up before you kill all these people, or these people, it's going to be your fault if you do something, you know. So those two experiences in life kind of helped me, be who I am. And so I cope better with these things.
Yeah, I could see that. Speaking of coping, in April, the International Council of Nurses warned that the world is facing a nursing crisis. They're saying the global nursing workforce of 27 million is likely to be cut by half over the next few years. The reasons? Disputes over pay, working conditions, and violence from patients. There's also the so-called COVID-19 effect, such as the lack of protection and long and stressful shifts. And these stress are having a profound impact on the mental health of nurses across the globe. What are your thoughts on the council's assessment? And can you relate to this?
Totally could relate to it. Even now, I think the nursing shortage, since I was a nurse, has always been a shortage. And I think it's going to get worse, like the council has said. Just another statistic to you. So if you look at the age of nursing, the baby boomer is a very large population of nurses. And eventually, in a few more years, they're going to retire and they're not going to be replaced. Because like the council has said, nursing is a very, very difficult job, which also, to me personally, is underpaid compared to other fields.
I've been a nurse for 15 years. I see the new nurses that come in. They don't stay in the field very long because either they get burnt out or they found out that this is not worth it. This is not worth my time. I could do something else to help people, but I'm not going to get treated this way.
What about you? Do you have any plans to leave nursing, or is this it for you?
This is it for me. This is what I love to do. This is what I want to do. I may want to go into maybe teaching a little bit more and something like that, but my career probably will end here and stay here as a nurse. That's what I enjoy doing.
That's great. I mean, it's one thing to work for money. It's another to enjoy what you're doing.
Yep.
On a more serious topic, you take care of the sick and dying. Sometimes you're the last person they see or talk to. What are some regrets they share with you? Things that they wish they had done differently, or not done at all while they were alive?
I had so many of those. I knew one of the things that one of the older gentlemen told me was, I wish I have spent more time with my family. That throughout the year, he was so busy working, and he never really had any enjoyment of what he worked for, what his money was, and his family they had built. He never enjoyed it because he was working so hard to be successful in those things, working so hard that you died and you didn't have a chance to enjoy it. And then he said, you know, if I would have done this all over, if the COVID wasn't here, I would spend more time with my family. I wouldn't concentrate on just making, and not spending time with these individuals I have. Now my kid is 18, he's in college, and he don't know who I am. You know, I have a family, I have a wife who never really ever see me. You know, I have a beautiful home, but I never really live in it. You know, and he said, why are we doing this to ourselves? The United States is running this way. Why? You know, and, you know, of course, I feel him when he say that. The way I was raised is different. My dad always raised, you don't need a big home. You don't need all these fancy cars. You don't need all these stuff. What you need is the people that are with you. You know, those people, your family, your friends, those are what makes you happy. You know, not the stuff that the more things you have, the bigger stuff you have, doesn't mean that you're happy. He was never happy, but he always wanted more. He was a business person. He said, yeah, my goal was when I was 25, I wanted to be a millionaire. So he made his first millionaire and he thought he was going to be happy. No, he wanted more. Then he had his set goal at 35. He's going to make, you know, roughly $5 million per year. And he did that. And then he thought he was going to be happy. Well, no, he's never happy. He wanted more until COVID hit. And then he left his kid, his wife, his family on the sideline watching him doing what he does best, which is making money.
Mm. So what's the moral of the message here? Money is not going to make you happy. Meeting your ambitions is not going to make you happy. It's having friends, loved ones, and sharing moments together. It's about having experiences, right?
I think money do, to a certain extent. I think money do. I think I read some studies somewhere. It says, you know, if you make roughly around $60,000 to $70,000 a year, you're pretty happy. You make anything more than that, happiness never changed.
Yeah, I think I read the same article. Apparently, the latest one says that financial happiness starts at $85,000. After that, happiness is an inside job, as we know. Let's talk about something that is the opposite of money, which is compassion. Nursing demands compassion. What is your definition of compassion? And how do we incorporate this in our lives?
Compassion, I think, means differently. I don't think everybody compassion means the same way. Let's say if a patient is struggling with addiction, your compassion maybe is understanding, is staying quiet, is caring how they feel, and then just absorbing in what their thoughts are. And then let's say if you have a different patient, like the COVID patient, who miss on life, your compassion to them is to understand how they feel and the family feel. So I think compassion for everyone, I think it means a little bit differently. And to practice this, I would say it starts off with yourself. You have to be healthy yourself to be compassionate to others. And it comes out and people could read you fairly quickly. Like I said, they could pay. I've been a nurse for so long. They know nurses who are doing things by the book, and they know nurses who are doing it by their from their hearts right away. Yeah, pick it up.
So they can sense the genuineness of it all.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Last question. To the teens who's depressed, alone, and contemplating suicide, what do you want to tell him or her?
I would say if you can accept that you are depressed, accept that this is a disease, and get help professionally, get help in a support, go to a support system with a professional. And I even go as far as if medication help, take it. Medication is not a cure, it's a bridge. If you bridge over your hard time so you don't end up hurting yourself, bridge it until you feel safe and wean yourself off it. And to me personally, it's important to have a very good, very, very, very good support system. Like the way when I went through my tough time, I think when I found my little group in middle school helps me a lot. And no, I did not have a professional person who helps me, but I think it would help me. I did not end up hurting myself. But if you are thinking about hurting yourself, I think first and most importantly, you need to get professional help. And second, importantly, you need to get a support group. And third, importantly, medication to bridge over the harsh time.
Thank you for that great message. What I got out of that was that you're not in this alone and you don't have to be alone in your time of struggles. Here's my conclusion. My takeaway from our conversation today is gratitude. Thank you for your role as a first responder, your commitment to caring for others, and for your vulnerability. Suicide is a taboo topic, especially in our culture. Yet we went there, and I'm glad we did. Thank you for sharing your story, Mitch. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoy listening to my guest journey from surviving to thriving as Khmer in America, and for the lessons they have learned and shared with us. For more stories like this, visit us at voacambodia.com. Until next time, I'm Manny, your host of Bayan Bayou with Manny.